Hello, everyone. It's so lovely to be here today in Ludbury. I'd like to say a huge welcome to everyone in the audience and to everybody tuning in around the world via Zoom. It's an absolute pleasure to be able to introduce Vidyun Ravindran and Seni Senivaratne for a reading and discussion of Sri Lankan and diasporic poetry. Before we start, I'd like to thank Arts Council England as the principal funder of this event. Seni Senivaratne is a writer of English and Sri Lankan heritage and is published by People Tree Press. Wild Cinnamon and Winter Skin, The Heart of It, and Unknown Soldier are her latest collections. Unknown Soldier is a Poetry Book Society recommendation, a National Poetry Day choice, and was highly commended in the Forward Poetry Prizes in 2020. She has collaborated with filmmakers, visual artists, musicians, and digital artists, and is one of 10 commissioned writers on the Colonial Countryside Project. Along with Vidyun and Shash Trevitt, another one of our excellent Ludbury critics, she is currently co-editing a Blood Axe anthology of post-independence Tamil, Sinhala, and English poetry, and is working on her fourth collection. Vidyun Ravindran was born in Leeds to Sri Lankan Tamils. His first book of poems, Grun Tumilani, was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for Best First Collection, the Shimasini Prize Center Poetry Prize, and the Michael Murphy Memorial Prize. His second, The Million-Petaled Flower of Being Here, won a Northern Writers Award and a Poetry Book Society recommendation. It was shortlisted for the 2019 Forward Prize for Best Collection, the 2019 T.S. Eliot Prize, and the 2021 Ledbury Monthly Poetry Prize for Second Collections. We're so privileged to be able to listen to two poets who ask amazing probing questions and conversation here today. And I hope that you think of some excellent questions for the Q&A that will be happening later. And without further ado, I'll hand over to Vidyun and Seni. Thank you very much.
We'll start in. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks so much, the organizers, and for having us here today. And it's slightly strange for us, as Seni and I were talking about, because of the events taking place in Sri Lanka as we speak, quite momentous events, where there's been an uprising against a corrupt government, which has been the result of the profound economic crisis that Sri Lanka is going through. And I guess we will talk about that a little bit here and now, but we're mostly here, of course, to read our own poems and also to share with you some poems from the anthology of Sri Lankan and diasporic poetry, which we're editing at the moment. With the one, Shash Trevitt, who unfortunately can't be here with us.
Yeah, and one of the things we wanted to say, particularly about the anthology, is that our mission really for the anthology is to bring together poets from based in Sri Lanka and based around the world across all the divisions that have been imposed on us in the country of our origin. And that's been a very important way that we've approached the anthology, to bring together Tamil speakers, Sinhala speakers, English speakers, and to work on getting translations and bringing all those poets together to speak in their diverse voices, really, about their experiences. And we just want to say hi to Shash, who is on Zoom. So we're going to start off by reading some poems from the anthology. And having mentioned Shash, I'm going to start off reading one of her poems that's actually going to go in the anthology. Shash has been a very important third person in pulling this together. She's done some amazing translations from Tamil, and kept us in order with all the good organization skills, spreadsheets, and yeah. So it feels right that we should start off today with a poem from her. And it's called My Grandfather's House. There is moss growing in the bedrooms of my grandfather's house, green and sticky, staining the walls and the floor with shades of the sea. They climb, tracing intricate patterns around brown squares where pictures used to hang. The roof has fallen in. Water stagnates on a cushioned floor as disturbed bats circle, drawing the night in. The rooms are empty of all that was him. The doors have been locked, warped, and unwilling to open onto a tomorrow which does not contain him. It is 6 o'clock, and the mosquitoes gather noisily in the rooms that once smelt of sweet margosa leaves. They are the music makers, the sum total of our dreams, the inheritors of rooms that reek and sweat in angry dismay. There is moss growing in the bedrooms of my grandfather's house, and raindrops sing a lament on deserted floors. I'm now going to read one of the poems in the anthology that's been translated from Sinhala. It's been translated by Iniyage Amarakirthi, and it's by Vipuli Hetiarachi. Vipuli was a 2005 winner at the National Festival for her collection On Butterflies' Wings. She writes in Sinhala, and many of her poems concern women and their place in society. We are women. Anyone home? Housecoat buttoned quickly up over the nightdress, the voice hardly able to reply. Is there anybody there? They have come on a task assigned. Still half asleep, mother struggles to find words and to prevent her face and body freezing. I switch on lights from room to room. To ensure safety in the town, they search a house that has no visitors or lodgers, not even a dog. Where are the men of the house? Sniffing, even at our minds that have harmed not even an ant, they look around with suspicion. Only both of you? On other days, my mother would lie that her husband would return soon and her son was at work, but her wits that always found the right word for the right time and place were not working today. In front of a crowd of men wearing uniforms and stars with guns in their hands, I scream, yes, who else? We are the men who have survived in this home. The next poem is a translation from Tamil by Sasha Ebeling, and it's written by Pakkianathan Ahilan. He was born in Jaffna, northern Sri Lanka, in 1970. He's lived through the 30-year civil war on the island. He's an academic as well as a poet. He's published 3 collections of poetry and is a senior lecturer in art history at the University of Jaffna. He is one of the most influential poets writing in Tamil in Sri Lanka at the moment. The poem is called A Poem About Your Village and My Village. 1. I do not know. I do not know if your village is near the ocean with its wailing waves or near a forest. I do not know your roads made from red earth and lined with tall jute palms. I do not know the birds of your village that come and sing in springtime. I do not know the tiny flowers along the roadsides that open their eyelids when the rain pours down. I do not know the stories you tell during long nights to the sound of drumbeats or the ponds in your village where the moon goes to sleep. 2. Tonight, when even the wind is full of grief, you and I know one thing. Our villages have become small, or perhaps large, cemeteries. The sea with its dancing waves is covered with blood. All forests with their trees reaching up to the sky are filled with scattered flesh and with the voices of lost souls. During nights of the war, dogs howl, left to themselves, and all roads and the thousands of footprints our ancestors left behind are grown over with grass. We know all this, you and I. We now know about the flowers that died, the abandoned lines of poetry, the moments no one wants to remember. 3. But do you know if the burnt grass still has roots, or if the abandoned poems can still be rooted in words? If, like them, you do not know whether our ancient flames are still silently smouldering deep down in that ocean covered with blood, notice today. They say that after he had lain in hiding for 1,000 years, one day the sun rose again. That feels like a good place to end my contribution from the anthology. And I was just thinking as I read it, the people have risen again.
Yeah, thank you, Sunny. It's wonderful. And what I'm going to do also is read 3 poems from the anthology. And like Sunny, I'll read a poem that was originally written in English by an Anglophone poet, and I'll read a poem that was originally written in Tamil. I'm going to read the translation, and I'll read a poem that was originally written in Sinhala in translation, because that's the structure of our book, to include poetry from all 3 languages. One of the things that distinguishes the protests going on now is of people coming together from very different backgrounds, of Hindus, Buddhists, Muslims, all coming together to try and change what's going on in a country where many people don't have enough food, don't have enough fuel, don't have enough medical resources. So in our anthology, what we've tried to do is, instead of segregating the say the Tamil poems from the Sinhala poems, we're going to try and juxtapose them. And what we're planning to do at the moment is to arrange the book alphabetically, because really we want people from very different backgrounds to be kind of conversing with each other within the boundaries of the anthology. So I'll begin with an English language poet. So her name was Alfreda da Silva, and she was just this really exciting discovery we made when, you know, we're pulling books from archives, searching the internet, and even in the relatively obscure history of Anglophone 20th century Sri Lankan poetry, which not many people know about, her name just doesn't tend to appear. But so when we found her poems, we were just struck by their beauty. She had 2 collections of poetry. They're both out of print, and they really need to be back in print. So she died in 2001. She worked at the Ministry of Education in Sri Lanka. She did radio broadcasts. She also wrote books for children. She wrote a beautiful prose memoir called Pagoda House about her childhood in her grandmother's house. And this is a poem for which there are 4 or 5 versions. I think it's one of those cases where a poet realizes that, in a way, this is the poem they were born to write, and in her case, to rewrite. And she just kept going back to it throughout her life. And this is one of my favorite versions of it, and it's called Grass Fields in Sunlight. Now, at one end of them, the squatters' shacks hurt the eyes with their tin white roofs, and the stench of rotting dirt piled on the tree roots disturbs the old images. Once these were fields turned into seas or mountains by childhood, and the wind's cries were horses' hooves, and the whining grass a tale one listened to in the moth-brushed night. I remember the sun over these fields, like a fisherman netting in green water, shocking everything with its scathing radiance on a day that fell in the reeds and was irretrievable. So it's just, you have all these incredibly beautiful poems that they're also sort of uncanonical, out of print, you know, no one's read them. It's this national literature, which has never really been collected as a national literature, you know, has never been conceptualized or published in this sense or read about or studied. You know, there have been many wonderful anthologies of Indian poetry, you know, that have really played an important role in the evolution of Indian poetry and how it's understood, but there's never been a definitive anthology of Sri Lankan and diasporic poetry. The poetry of people both in Sri Lanka and people who've left Sri Lanka, either through voluntary migration or forced migration and exile. So this second poem was originally written in Tamil, and I'm going to read it in Shasha's brilliantly sensitive translation. And it's by K.P. Aravindan, which was the pen name of Christopher Francis, who was born in 1953 in northern Sri Lanka, who was an early pioneer of the Tamil freedom struggle, who was imprisoned several times, had to leave Sri Lanka in 1991 as a refugee to France, and who died in 2015. And it's called Directions. If you stand facing the rising sun, the west will fall at your back. The north wind will embrace you from the left. The hot wind blowing to your right is the south wind. The north, the south, the hot southwesterlies, the east. Each wind bears the weight of the name of each compass point. With such simple clarity, Amma taught me my poles a long time ago. Now I am rudderless, unable to tell one direction from the next. Here, the winds don't seem laden with names. A storm appears, but do storms too have directions? Meanwhile, I stand removed, an outsider, trying to fix my directions. Each time I fail. What has happened to them? Have they been lost? My memories tell me I set out from the north, but you came from the south, say the unfriendly voices in this cold land. I came from somewhere, but in which direction am I traveling now? Those who came from me raise their voices. Which direction should I face? Unlike my mother, who taught me so carefully, I am unable to teach my children. I do not have her simplicity, her patience. If only someone would point me in the direction of the rising sun, tomorrow I will stand facing the dawn. I will know my compass points, and I will be able to teach my children. And so, a final poem from the anthology, this one translated from Sinhala, again by Leonaga Amarakirthi. And the poet's name is Aryavansa Ranavira. And this is a poet who not only published many volumes of poetry, but was also a translator, was a literary critic, and whose poems often operate through kind of understatement, irony, and brevity. And I wanted to read this poem because we have a book that has a lot of atrocity-focused poetry in it, but that's not the only kind of thing that Sri Lankan poetry can do. You know, there is formal innovation amongst Sri Lankan poets to match the formal innovations of, you know, Anglo-American poets or poets from all over the world. And this poem seems very simple, but it also seems to me very beautiful. And it's called The Intersection. I love that intersection where one path leads to a certain little house. A few dwarf stores, their old plank doors half closed, break the deserted loneliness, and stray dogs with mouths down on the ground sleep here and there. It's just an intersection with nothing special about it. Yet I love that intersection with one path leading to a certain little house.
Right.
Okay, so now we're going to read some of our own poems, and Seni's going to go first.
Right. Okay, I only decided to read this poem after I'd arrived here in Ledbury because I went to see the amazing Ovid film. I don't know if anybody else saw it, but it reminded me that in my new book that's due to come out, there's a sequence based on one of Ovid's stories in the Metamorphoses, and so I decided I wanted to read a little one of the poems out of it. So it's based on it's a kind of reimagining of Philomela's story, and what I'm trying to do really is to put a lot of the story into her own words and her own experience. So this is one of them. It's called Philomela in Her Own Words. If anybody doesn't know the story, I mean, basically she was raped by her brother-in-law and left in the forest, and afterwards, and then he lied to her sister about what had happened. One. Night after night, his hollow bones stalk my dreams like a death mask. He's all talk, all promises and bunches of dead roses, telling me I can trust him like family. And I can never remember why I shouldn't. He's bloody in the flame's trick of light, but I'm the one in pieces, with no time to run before the candle's snuffed out. Two. I remember that I left, like leaving wounded bodies behind on a battlefield. I was up in the trees, looking down on the slaughter, and it was my body down there, mauled by the enemy, mouth open as if calling and calling, though in my ears there was only a cacophony of birdsong that would not be silenced. Three. Were there signs I should have read, omens I ignored? The trees mock me, their leaves falling like silent tongues turned to mulch on the forest floor. I count for nothing. I see reflections of myself in the cracked mirrors that hide in their bark, replaying my shame. I should have done better, trusted less, run faster. Four. Felled trees are monuments to my demise. Their twisted limbs kick the air, as mine did. I was nothing but dead wood, stripped bark, and pinned like his trophy to the forest floor. What use is beauty without respect? What use is kinship without trust? I'd rather be half bird, half woman, than prey to the fangs of wild men. The rain dilutes everything. I am disappearing. So if you want to read the rest of that sequence, you'll need to look out for my next book, which is coming out in autumn next year. So I'm going to read a few poems from my the last book that came out, which was The Unknown Soldier. And it was based on photographs of my father's from the Second World War. He fought for the British Army in the Royal Signals in North Africa, and I have a series of photographs of his which are in the book, and I wrote these poems based on that. I'm going to read poems from the second section, which is really poems that I'm addressing my father, or considering some of the issues that arose from war in general. The first half of the book is really in the voice of both my father and the photographer. So I'm going to start with Full Moon. I want to tell you about last night's full moon and the strange peace I found reading about your war. Circles on my map of North Africa mark the battle sites. I plot the grid lines of minefields, gaps you'd crawl through with telephone cables. I can't place you, but no doubt you were under the full moon, 28th of May 1942, listening to the rumble of bombs along the Gazala line. The moon was there every month, looking down on the catastrophe of war as it still does, in places far from this garden, where I listen to the woodpecker and watch the robin fight the blue tit for a space on the feeder. I'm filling in the details because you never could. Why tell more than you need? Why bring the war back home? All right. My next poem. The next poem is a kind of, so one of the things I also have is some of the letters that my dad sent both to England and to Sri Lanka, Ceylon as it was then, from the troop ship when he was on his way to North Africa. So I wrote him a reply. Dear Dad, does this seem odd, this replying to letters sent all those years ago from a troop ship? What with me not due to be born for another 10 years, and you dead now this past 30. No matter, I know you at least believed in an afterlife, so I'll hope you are receiving me. That reference to your trip on the Arama from Ceylon to England 12 years ago makes me sorry I never asked you more about that crossing as well as this one. How optimistic you sound, that familiar glass half full attitude that you always had. 148 men squeezed into cramped mess quarters to eat and sleep, and you're writing about how the hammock's comfortable enough for a good night's rest. It's so typical of you to think of going up on deck when rough seas made the mess unbearable. Wrapped up in your greatcoat and balaclava, did you watch the stars until you fell asleep? I'll write more soon. This is just a short note to say, wherever you are, I am thinking of you. And because I've written a letter to my dad, I wrote a letter to my mum because I realised I've written a whole book about my dad, and my mum, who's from Yorkshire, I could hear a voice in my head from the afterlife, saying, like, oh, you know, what's all this about? Why does he get a whole book? So I decided to write. Maybe that'll have to come next anyway. But anyway, in the meantime, I've written this poem. Dear Mum, not a word from you until today. I was pegging out the washing, and it was as if you were there next to me, reaching to fasten a sheet in loops on my washing line. You were always a say it like it is, speak as you find, no nonsense. Some might call it sharp-tongued kind of person. So your silence had surprised me. And there's no criticism implied. I'm grateful to you for teaching me to speak my mind and for the cushion of love, the space for comfort in the crook of your arm. I've been wondering about your war years, how it felt to be the one he left behind in 1941. And all the waiting. You wrote letters. Your sister helped you with the spelling. Not your fault you were taken out to school at 13 to be the one who helped at home, what with my grandma having her mother and a sick relative to look out for. That bout of TB when you were 6 can't have helped. Nearly 2 months alone in a sanatorium, you told me. No visitors allowed, looking out for them every day. Must have been 5 years before you saw my dad again, not knowing whether he'd survive. Not to mention his posting to Ceylon, the worry he'd decide to stay on. It was a long engagement for sure, but the wedding photo told its own story. Head held high, you're looking round at all the guests as if to say, see, he was worth the wait. I'll write more soon. Glad you came to break the silence. I can still hear your voice, those broad Yorkshire vowels asking me, why is your dad getting all the attention? I I think I might stop there because I'm just looking at the time and I don't want to.
Okay, sure. Then. Thanks, yes. Senny.
And no. Let her have the last word anyway.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful poem. No, I was just thinking, like, another bond between Senny and I is that I grew up in Leeds, so in West Yorkshire. So over the course of the pandemic, we've been having these video calls with the two of us and Shash to talk about the anthology. As I moved to the US in January 2020, right before the pandemic hit, and we weren't able to travel back to England because of the travel ban. You know, our families couldn't come to see us, and we felt very isolated. And it was always so cheering to talk to Shash and to Senny, also to hear Senny's accent, because, you know, it's a Sri Lankan thing, but it's also a Yorkshire thing. Okay, so I'll read two poems from my first book, and then a couple of sonnets from the second book. So this poem is called The Pandanus, and it's about a particular kind of tree you get in Sri Lanka, which has a very strange appearance because it has what are called aerial roots. So the branches grow back down into the earth and then become more tree trunks. So it's sort of like it keeps spreading sideways and outwards. Recently, I didn't know this when I wrote this poem, but recently I was teaching my students Paradise Lost, you know, Milton's Paradise Lost, and I realized that for the second tree, the tree from which Adam and Eve take the leaves to cover themselves up, Milton chose the pandanus. Or in fact, he kind of got confused and mixed it up with a banana tree, which would actually have leaves big enough to, you know, cover you up, whereas a pandanus wouldn't. But it was a very interesting moment for me that, you know, there's this very Sri Lankan tree just in the middle of this this English epic, this canonical poem. Anyway, so this poem, there's two words and I should explain. Like, one is Shivalingam. Shivalingam is a sort of religious object, and a crude definition of it would be like it's a phallic shape, but really it's sort of about the intersection point between the formless and form, which, you know, is relevant to a poet, of course. And finally, the poem ends with the word dones, which is a word Henry James uses for the first thing that sparks off an idea for a novel, you know, the done. The pandanus hunkered by the beach wall, daubed with the Disney B-list, bleached by constant sun, overachieves like Caliban. Its trunk a shivalingam atop this magnified birdcage of roots with no bird in it, a listening structure that stripes with shadow the sand like a tiger. Come dusk, the Colombo skylines, dot, 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 picks out as the tide comes in the floating halves of coconuts, cleaved by a machete and filled with a curse, with grave ash and menses, and thrown into the sea. Each mist wall the sea throws up is capons to the pandanus, who knows the air crammed with glittering dones. And this second poem from the first book is called Rambutan, and this is a kind of fruit that you eat in Sri Lanka. I could describe it to you, but then I do that thing where the introduction just, you know, uses up all the material in the poem. So I think I'll just read it. Rambutan. Between the elephant orphanage at Dambulla, whose house-high hunter-blinded tusker with his rubbery, cross-hatched, stiff-haired hide keeps stock still as granite in the shade, and the spice garden, where over herbal tea into which was spooned a sugar or three, my parents were sold on the rejuvenating magic of the real thing, unprocessed turmeric. It must have been 100 miles we drove through a steaminess of palm tree groves, past dozens of identical stalls, old hands piled high with batiks and bananas, garlands of postcards flashing in the light, where we bought not a single one of those pyramid-heaped red fruit, dusty balls with flexible prongs like Nerf ammunition, or a stress-relieving toy for executives. It seems rambutan vendors replenish their displays constantly, either that or no one ever buys any. The dust on these tough red skins, too rarely peeled back by the calloused thumbs that make it down this track, to expose the clear meat like an eyeball's, you must learn to scrape off with your teeth around its hard red stone. Thank you. Form, rhyme, we get action. So I'm a poet, so obsessed with form, and the second book is a book of sonnets. And some of the sonnets are quite strict, some of them much looser, and it's a book of sonnets to my wife. It was a really difficult period of my life, and I sort of got to a point of feeling there was no one really listening, that no one really understood me, that only sort of my wonderful wife, Jenny, really did. So I started writing her these sonnets quite in private, and, you know, those aren't in the book. But then gradually I realized that that form could be turned into poems for a book. And so I published them sort of with two sonnets to a page, so the idea is that they're sort of in conversation. So this first poem is called Ceylon, and it's about how Jenny, my wife, pronounces the word Ceylon differently to I do, Ceylon. And it's got some, I am an academic, I try not to add academic poetry, but there's some terms here to do with poetic feet, iams and trochees. So to pronounce it Ceylon is a troche because the stress comes on the first syllable, whereas Ceylon is an iam because, you know, stress comes on the second syllable. And it's also about tea because, you know, we grow tea in Sri Lanka and it's drunk so much over here. And there's a whole colonial history to do with that. But I'll just tell you instead, short story, if you go to Sri Lanka and you go to the uplands, to Nuwaralia, it's beautiful, it's a cool and in a mountain area where they grow the tea. And you can go on tours of, you know, the tea estates, and they'll show you the very best tea, the broken orange pekoe, and then they'll show you the different grades of tea. And I was there and we asked, you know, so what kind of tea makes it into, you know, your English tea bags, like Tetley? And the guy said, dust. These are points on the floor. And that's their technical term for it, dust, right? That's the leavings, right? Okay, so Ceylon. Ceylon, the words on the tip of your tongue, or as you say it, tongue, as we take tea. Waiting for you to speak, I sip mine. Tetley's tastes of nothing, but I suppose it's good to know true flavorlessness, the prose of life we sugar over with furs. Ceylon, you say, a troche, not an iam, referring to the drink I drink with two spoonfuls at home, and here, none. Though by home, I mean the house my parents live in and where I grew up, like and unlike them saying back at home when they intend Sri Lanka and not Leeds, where they live and I haven't, not for years. So it's sort of a, you know, I'm versatile in that, you know, I can drink tea with sugar in or without sugar in, and people just give you this look like, what's wrong with you? It's like, there's some kind of, you're some kind of monster. You know, if you can enjoy tea both ways. Okay, and this is a poem about visiting Sri Lanka, you know, with my wife, and the experience of, you know, going into quite rural areas and of her being stared at because, you know, she was a white woman in these places, and, you know, how, you know, not in a hostile way, just in a curious way, but about how kind of unpleasant that was for her, you know, being the minority in that place. And so I was interested in this book of sonnets of talking about the sorts of experiences that don't usually get into a sort of racialized discourse, you know, the sort of discomforts we pass over. So it's got outside the Hanuman temple. Hanuman is a monkey god. Outside the Hanuman temple, in the sweating foothills of Rambodha, our round guide, serene as the Buddha, said to wait, and for claustrophobic hours we did, among countless locals awaiting the god, the measly monkey statue carried aloft. I didn't notice at the time, but you were stared at by men with dark ovals at their underarms, by women holding garlands, by children and the old. To be respectful, you wore a long, flowing dress. No one there, including me, looked like you, so they looked at you, mingling swift glances and that shameless, long, unbroken stare. It's shameful that I didn't notice what it was like for you in that place. Okay, and this is, I'll read two more sonnets and then we'll have a chat about things. Thing about sonnets is you can read them quickly, but you don't really want 10 sonnets fired at you because it's just like boom, 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 boom. So two more. This sonnet is called Worry. You know, I come from a very, very anxious family, and I've learned to understand that in terms of a kind of Sri Lankan Tamil intergenerational trauma, if you like, sort of not feeling quite safe anywhere. But of course, many, many people feel anxious, especially nowadays. And I hope that there's some poems in this collection which might speak to that, no matter what your background is. And so this poem sort of begins with some advice from, cognitive behavioral therapy style advice about what to do about worry. But there's also a little joke in this poem because there's a joke in our family that we're from the warrior caste, or rather the weaver caste, but sometimes called the warrior caste, but really it should be the warrior caste because no one's worrying. Okay, so worry. And you notice I often run the title of the poem into the first line. I'm really bad with titles, so I found that that's a nice way around it. I get a lot of poets do that, but I probably learned it or stole it from Ted Hughes, actually. Okay. Worry isn't doing something about the problem. Train yourself out of these thoughts. So they say. But I think of my dad coming upstairs to ask in his quiet, sad voice, can we leave in 10 minutes for the station, even though it's an hour till my train back to you, and he doesn't want me to go. His father's fists turned him mild as a Jane to his son, me. A boxing champion, he'd jog in his crop top round the lagoon hunting snakes. Then he flew here, alone. No wonder our tribe is of the warrior caste, thinking always of the vanished countries of the past and future, to draw a line between and know that we abide. And one last poem, and this is really another, it's a translation. It's a translation from Tamil that I wrote with my father's help. And it's a translation of a poem by his mother, my grandmother, Kamala Bhushani Thirunavakarasu, who I never met, died before I was born. And she was a headmistress in a school in Batticolo, but she was also much more than that. She did all kinds of work with so-called fallen women, really women who fell through the cracks. It's quite a sexist society and like that. And she wrote poems in her notebook. She wasn't known as a poet or anything like that. We found these poems in a notebook. My dad Englished them for me, and then I tried to turn them into poems. And this one seemed to fit in this book of sonnets. So it's called Party, which is sort of a Tamil word for one's paternal grandmother. Dawn, darkness is done with, gone from the earth. The sun's red face makes the shapeless once again distinct. Foliage smothering the path. The kanaka flowers like painted cups amid a tiny forest. As one corolla withers, there bursts the next from its green spike. The achieved bloom has learned to seduce. The closed bud just below goes untouched even by the shadow of an insect. Just a leaf, the bee says, Today's flame shrivels, but why make a fuss? The flower of tomorrow is yet to open. Thank you. Okay, so what's going on now? We're sort of chatting, but also people can ask us questions.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to chat for a little bit. Maybe people will ask questions. And there's somebody with their hand up there. Oh, no, there's a microphone up there.
There's a microphone
up
there.
So that if anybody wants to ask a question, but we might have something to say first. I don't know.
Yeah, do you have anything really clever to say?
You know, I think it's important to... I was thinking as we talked about this before, we were both asked to read here, and in a way, I'm thinking, oh, I wish I'd read that, and oh, it's a shame there's not more time to read this and give you more of a flavour of things from my other books. And actually, it feels really relevant that we made the decision to make a space for voices that aren't heard. So. I was sitting here thinking through all that and thinking, well, yeah, it would have been nice to have a little bit longer, but yeah, actually, in a way, I know why we made that decision, because, a lot of the work that I do is about kind of unheard voices and giving voice to people, you know, as in the Philomela poem and other poems that are written. So, in a way, to have been part of this anthology and discover... As a person who grew up in this country, and so my connections with Sri Lanka are more tenuous, really, to discover all these poets that I hadn't heard of and who hadn't been heard of, and even the ones writing in English, has been a big revelation. And then the whole process of working together with Vidyun and Shash has been, it's kind of a mixture, it's been an education, but it's also been such a pleasure. This is the first time I've met Vidyun in person. It just feels good to be able to do this with him, because sometimes when we're having these heated debates over the thing, you know, you just want to kind of,
punch
you know,
someone.
Yeah, just have a bit of a jostle about things. It's amazing that we've met the three of us online for 2.5 years maybe, yeah. and yet we feel like family. We feel like we know each other really well, and we talk about the anthology, but we also drift off into talking about all sorts of other things, our personal lives, about the poetry world, all sorts of things. And it's been such a it's just filled me up with so much, really. It just feels like part of that whole process it's been. It's about making a space, and we're hoping that that's what the book will do, is to make a space for people who've never had the opportunity to be heard. And some of them have already died, and they've never had that opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, we talk on neglected poets in this country, and obviously there are neglected poets. And poets are the kind of people who usually feel neglected all the time. But how often do we really read poetry from outside the UK or the US? I mean, that's a question that's occurring to me more and more now, that we do look for a more diverse sort of poetry list, but we generally understand that in terms of Anglo-American diversity. And you know, it's not even, you know, a global South thing. Like, we don't, you know, how many of us read poetry from Canada or Australia or anything? So it's just really exciting to find these poets that, you know, again, just not on the radar before. I just have to say something back about how wonderful it's been for me to be able to chat with both Shash and Seni over this very difficult 2 years, you know, years that have been difficult for everyone in this room and out of this room. Because I moved to the US in January 2020, and then, you know, everything hit. But also that the conditions of talking about the anthology digitally seem sort of appropriate in a way, because it's an anthology also of diasporic poetry. And my family, my extended family from sort of Sri Lankan Tamil diaspora, has always acted like, and this goes back to before the pandemic, has always acted like talking on Zoom is the same as being there in person. But I think this is a coping mechanism that's developed because of a family that's had to spread all over the world. So, you know, with people in Australia, people in Canada. And my cousins, Australia and Canada, you know, Skype my uncle in Colombo, and they don't even necessarily talk. It's just like, you know, here is a window on one sitting room in one country, and there's a window on another sitting room in another country. So it's like a way of being digitally together. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if that leads into anything. But
I mean,
yeah,
there's just one other thing I wanted. The other exciting thing has been finding work online by younger poets in Sri Lanka, a lot of whom are probably involved in some of what's happening there now and the sort of push for change. And to find that work and, you know, to find kind of performance poets and seeing if any of their work could sort of translate onto the page and still work. And, you know, people who identified as non-binary or gender fluid or queer or whatever, you know, just feeling that there's that sort of, yeah, this kind of, this new wave of young poets really that we've rooted out through the internet, again, through this fact that we can go online and watch a YouTube and see somebody and think, oh wow, we'll look and see if there's anything that we can get from that person. And that's also been really exciting.
So we hope we have a mixture of, you know, poets who write up to here and now and spoken word sort of experimental prose poetry hybrids, but we've also got poets, you know, who maybe if they've been writing in another country back in the mid 20th century or even slightly earlier than that, you know, George Cape, that goes back to the 30s, might be a canonical poet on your reading lists now, you know, school, university, but they're not because they're Sri Lankan. So those poets will come back out of, you know, the void and they'll have their place, but it will be alongside these poets, you know, very much of the present. So that's the idea.
All right, I think we have time for maybe one question. So if anyone has anything particularly burning they may like to ask. Put your hand up very, very straight, right about now, and then I think the poet would usually like to read a poem to read us out.
Hi, I just wanted to share some lovely comments from the audience outside the room.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, it's not my parents, is it?
It might be.
Okay.
There's never enough time for everything. I thought the balance of your own work and the voices of others, especially in translation, was perfect. Well done, both of you. Beautifully narrated, powerful poems. Really enjoyed it. I think Polly Atkin, who's here earlier in the week, I think a lot of geographically separated families feel like that with video chats, a way to be together when you're not. I loved hearing your poems and poems from the anthology. Great mix. Amazing reading. Thank you. So lots of comments.
Well, thank you. Yeah, no, it seems appropriate because we're talking about that, you know, those connections across great distance that's technologically enabled. I mean, we'll be around afterwards if anyone wants to chat or ask questions then, we could do it.
Would you like to read us
out? Do you want to go first?
I can do.
Yeah.
Well, inspired by Vidian reading all those love poems, I'm going to read us out with a love poem, and it's one that's coming in my next collection. when you're kind of, when you're in a relationship with somebody who carves wood, you have to be prepared for anything, really. And this is what this poem is about, anyway. My light-boned lover. My light-boned lover has taken to carving corvids. The numbers are growing. If we pass them in fields, she stops the car suddenly, waiting for takeoff. She spends hours studying their form, shoulders hunched, smearing bold lines of charcoal over page after page. She says it's her wings when her back is aching. Won't take the tablets the hospital sent to strengthen her hollow bones. I know it's only a matter of time. Yesterday, I caught her gazing longingly at their silhouettes in the trees on the horizon. They came early this morning in a circling racket, a fly past above the skylight, I jumped out of bed yelling at them, "You can't have her. She's my light-boned lover. Her wings are not grown yet, not yet. You can't have her, not yet, not yet."
Okay, I'll read one more sonnet. And this is, I haven't really read this sonnet publicly before. So it's about a photograph I lost when we were broken into when I was living in Birmingham. And my wallet was taken, and it had money in it, obviously, but also this photograph. And later, the burglars sort of left the wallet on a wall slightly down the road. So they didn't steal the wallet, but the picture wasn't inside. So this is my last memory of this picture. And it's a picture of my mother and my sister taken back in Sri Lanka. And it's in black and white, right? So it's almost like it feels much more ancient than that. My sister, just as a toddler, and she was still a toddler when eventually they moved to England. So it must have been taken slightly before that. Mother and sister. Waist deep in zinnias by the window, one cradles the other. The photos, black and white, faded, seems oddly Victorian, except these are my people. I don't know the color of the bands of plaster standing proud of the wall that's rubble now. Someone, somewhere, is a wound speaking, an ear listening. I can imagine, comes the reply. Souls touch only as stems and petals are half perceived through a sari's silk, as thoughts of the real world's harms haunt the child in her mother's arms. We look and look until we almost feel the past is no foreign country after all. Thank you.